Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This hour on The Brian Lehrer Show, Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman on their widely emailed New York Times Magazine article about why some kids seem to perform better under pressure than others, and we'll take your calls for them. And we will begin a series on English language idioms, phrases you use. Where did they come from? And we'll get right to all this after I tell you that this is day one of our first membership drive of 2013. And we're just going to do this for a few seconds here, and I hope you'll all donate something to help us run the station. That's all I want to say. You can do it while we talk to Poe and Ashley at WNYC.org. It'll take much less time than our interview. You can call in to 1-888-376-WNYC if you want to do it on the phone, 1-888-376-9692, or pledge online at WNYC.org. And all I can say is thanks for considering it. Now, one of the most emailed New York Times articles so far this year was that magazine piece by Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman on why some kids can handle pressure while others fall apart. Their book-length treatment of the topic is out now, called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. And it's a really interesting dive into biology and social science and how they combine to affect our lives in various ways. So Poe Bronson, Ashley Merriman, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
The article begins with a story of two brothers, kids named Noah and Jacob, who were both in gifted and talented classes in school, but one tended to thrive on standardized tests while the other tended to break down. And do you think a lot of parents could relate, and that's why the article got so widely passed around?
Very much so. We interviewed lots of kids and parents who – the parents of kids who have test-taking anxiety. And they found this phenomenon to be true. They also had that themselves. And they were very surprised to hear that there could be a genetic link between them, which sometimes would explain why a parent felt this but her husband did not, and then one kid has it, and then the other kid does not.
So not to oversimplify, your book and article are both about genetic and experiential causes of how we deal differently with stress. So we'll get back to Noah and Jacob. But first, let's lay a little foundation by talking about the stress itself. And you make a point, Ashley, of distinguishing between long-term stress and short-term stress. Why is that?
Right. Well, I think people right now – they do lump all of them together, and stress is always bad. But the research is not saying stress universally is bad. Stress, the long-term, the chronic, day after day, yes, there's a host of biological consequences, psychological, for wearing your spirit down or always being anxious. However, acute response to a stress isn't a bad thing. If you're studying and then you have a final exam, you might get a little stressed out. You might be a little excited and looking forward to it. That's not a bad thing. That's showing that you actually care about this event. If you weren't stressed because something special was going on, then that might be more of a concern. So the research is actually finding that short-term stress can be productive if we understand it to be productive.
So short-term stress sometimes gets a bad rap. And you even write that recent research indicates that people who feel more anxiety during tests might actually do better than people who feel less, at least in some cases. Why might that be true?
Well, studies of novices versus professional musicians, athletes, dancers, they all get stressed. You might think those pros don't get stressed. They get absolutely anxious. They just report that anxiety as being beneficial to their performance. It gets them ready. They don't become a slave to overconfidence. You know, the fact that they're nervous and tense makes them prepare mentally, and they kind of their hormones come on and they get up for their performance. And so learning to see that short-term stress can be beneficial is crucial to unlocking performance in these environments.
Is stress related to desire? Would that be a good word to throw in here? Because sometimes when professional athletes retire or even professional musicians or other performers, they say they just don't have the desire that they used to have to keep them going under all these stressful situations.
Well, I think that excitement you know, and we wrote in the article that one of the researchers is frustrated that when people say, oh, I'm stressed, that means they're upset, they're anxious. It doesn't mean I have increased oxygen going to my blood, but they do. And I think that it's true that, you know, we were saying you can't get stressed if you don't care about something. So it's equating and stress and motivation. And if you're talking about someone who's been, I've just been doing this forever, they have lacked that motivation that was really exciting for them.
And one of the fascinating things to me in the book was your statement that the difference is how amateurs and professionals interpret stress. Not that professionals, because they've done it for 10,000 hours in their lives, don't experience stress.
Right. They're still engaged. They're still excited and looking forward to it. And in fact, it's really interesting. Research has found that elite athletes, warriors, are acutely sensitive to their heart rate increase. But they think to themselves, why is my heart rate going up? Is there something I need to do about it? Is this a problem? People who are prone to anxiety and panic attacks have the same acute sensitivity to heart rate increase, but they say, ooh, I'm going to have a panic attack.
Paul Brunson and Ashley Merriman, their new book called Top Dog. Let's get into one of the genetic components of performance under pressure that scientists are studying. That's really kind of a core element of the book. It's a gene known as the COMT gene, COMT, and its effect on dopamine. Want to tell us about that?
Sure. Well, in our prefrontal cortex of our brains, the modern contemporary part of our brains where we plan, we orchestrate complex thought, we do a lot of critical thinking, in this region of the brain, every time you're excited, every time you're nervous, dopamine is being squirted across your brain continuously. And you need to get rid of it because you have to maintain optimal levels of dopamine. You can't have too little and you can't have too much. And it's cleared by this COMT enzyme. And the COMT gene encodes two types of enzymes that clear away that extra dopamine. One clears it away rapidly and one clears it away slowly. So in our population, we have half of us have a mix of the two types of enzymes. One quarter of us have only rapid clearing enzymes and one quarter of us have only slow clearing enzymes. The result is a phenomenon that we're all familiar with, which is that we all know people who are really good performers, very smart, but under pressure and a lot of stress, they don't like it and they seem to kind of melt down. And then we have other people, friends of ours, me, who under a lot of stress and pressure, they seem to really turn it up. Maybe a little lackadaisical during the day, need a deadline to get going, but under pressure, you can kind of count on them. And that divergence, those two types of personalities, is explained by this gene.
But, you know, I never like to attribute complex behavioral and emotional responses to a single gene. It's not like how tall you grow, right? So do you write about genetic worriers and how they can best deal with their predispositions?
Well, you're right. We had the same thing. And this is not genetics aren't destiny. And what's interesting is that in the research they found, there are practice effects. So the worrier, I'm probably a worrier. I worry that I'm a worrier, so I think that probably is a good indicator. But the worriers in pilot training studies, the new pilots can get overwhelmed in a simulator. You know, too many things going on, and they just sort of melt down. And the warriors do better.
Wait, and these two genes you were describing, they're nicknamed right. the warrior gene and the warrior gene.
Right.
Right. The warrior gets up for these stressful situations and the warrior more is inclined to melt down.
Right. On a day-to-day basis, they have higher working memory, higher engagement ability to plan, but then they get too much dopamine and that's when they become overwhelmed.
Another way you put it is whether our bodies react to stress by flipping into a threat state or a challenge state.
Right. So the difference between threat and challenge physiology is fascinating. You know, people might have heard these studies of stereotype threat and standardized testing and wondered, why does just asking someone their gender before taking a math test have such a dramatic effect on the score? But if you understand that physiology, it starts to be not so surprising. Throughout our entire – all of our blood vessels are lined with smooth muscle. And these are controlled by nerves that run through our spinal cord. And instantaneously, we can constrict or we can open up and dilate those blood vessels. And in a challenged state, your heart's pumping, positive hormones are suppressing your fear networks, getting you excited about what you're going to, how you're going to do and what you're going to win. And the blood vessels all dilate and the blood flow and the blood volume, the oxygen is coursing through your body in a flash. And it can shift to a threat state. And everything constricts, your lungs constrict, your blood vessels constrict, blood pressure shoots up, oxygen stops going through your body, you can't tap into energy, and you start to have that panic or freeze-like moment. And considering how strong this physiology is, it's almost surprising that it doesn't cause more effects on people taking a test.
But here's one of the counterintuitive things in the book that also tends to break the link between genetics and necessary outcomes of behavior. You say that for those genetically predisposed to anxiety in pressure situations, an antidote might sometimes be more competition rather than less competition. Why might that be so?
Well, I think some of it is in the competition, you're choosing activities that you're going to be excited about. So they're limited in scope. It's not a day-to-day sort of demoralizing experience, but these moments of acute involvement and then rest and recovery. So those are what the researchers call sort of following the stress inoculation model. Little exposure to stress over time builds you almost an immunity to them. It doesn't change you. You don't, your genes don't change. You may still be susceptible to other kinds of stress, but you can over time in new contexts say, okay, I've already done this. I'm familiar with it, and then it's not so overwhelming.
Listeners, we're talking to Pope Bronson and Ashley Merriman, who wrote one of the most emailed New York Times articles of recent weeks, New York Times Magazine article on why some kids can handle pressure while others fall apart. Their book-length treatment of the topic is out now called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. We can take your phone calls for them at 212-433-WNYC. Want to ask about you or your kids or just some of the science here, brain science, et cetera, hormonal science, 212-433-9692. You can call in. And after the break, we'll take your calls and we'll also talk about why they critique standardized testing in the first place. So not only might you want to maximize your or your child's performance on standardized tests, they have what I think is a unusual, not the usual critique of standardized testing that we hear, but why they critique this in the first place, considering how our bodies react. So stay with us as we continue with Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue now with Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman, who wrote one of the most emailed New York Times articles so far this year, the magazine piece on why some kids can handle pressure while others fall apart. Their book-length treatment of the topic is out now called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. And we can take your phone calls now for Poe and Ashley at 212-433-212, right, this is our on-air line, not our pledge line. We'll never ask you for money on the air. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And while your calls are coming in, Poe, Ashley, first of all, welcome back.
Thank you.
And I was taking notes, so I congealed this into a list of five things that research is teaching us about stress that I got from your book last night. Long-term stress is almost always bad, whereas short-term stress can make us feel good and motivated. Scientists are exploring a gene called COMP that can be seen as warrior versus worrier gene. They occur about equally in people. Younger siblings tend to be more competitive and more tolerant of risk than firstborns. Sometimes anxiety can help us do better on tests rather than worse, And professional performers tend to interpret stress differently from amateurs, even though they also feel the same performance anxiety. So there, just for people tuning in right now, kind of taking notes on the first half of our conversation and from the book, there's a lot of the interesting stuff. And as the calls are coming in, I want to ask you about the science of birth order as it relates to this. And you conclude, Ashley, that younger siblings tend to be more competitive than firstborns. Who studied what about this?
Well, Frank Soloway has looked at baseball. There's over 700 pairs of brothers who played Major League Baseball. And he looked at their career records and found that the younger siblings were more competitive. They were more likely to steal bases. They're more likely to get caught. So they were taking risks. Their careers were about 2 years longer. They played about 180 more games. So that's one example of the research that he's done. There's also been experimental research in terms of how they interact. And what's interesting about siblings, and younger siblings specifically, is they always, from literally day one, know what it's like to deal with someone who's a bigger, stronger peer. And they have to think, how am I going to overcome this? Whereas the older sibling, or the only, I'm actually an only, Poe can actually tell you more about this life experience wise. Mm-hmm. But as an only child, I didn't ever have to compete with anyone. There was always extra cake. If I handed you my Barbie, it didn't occur to me that Barbie could come back with her head missing.
That's another fascinating set of studies that you reference in the book, that we have the stereotype that only children tend to be selfish because they were always the center of attention. But really, science indicates that they don't feel threatened by sharing because they didn't have that competitor who the sibling would have been.
That's right. I mean, siblings grow up competing over not just parental affection. They can compete over the remote control. They compete over toys. They compete over the iPad. They compete over food. You know, they compete over whose leg is where in the back seat of a car. And they get used to this. Maybe it's not real competition, like performance competition, but they get used to the psychological environment, the flushed emotions and intensity that people will need to bring with them to later competitions in life.
212-433-WNYC. And Dan in Manhattan, you're on with Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. Hi, Dan.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
So I'm a teacher in New York City, and my question is, I often administer state exams, and how can I identify who is the worrier versus the warrior, and how can I help the worrier reduce their testing anxiety?
Great question, Dan. You know, as a teacher, so you're giving these kids these annual standardized exams. You're not necessarily talking about the SAT. And they have to take it. You know, they're not in a situation where they can defray it or take it multiple times. They can take the SAT. So in terms of identifying them, you know, I coach soccer and I begin to feel this out with your kids. You'd see some version of this on just in each semester exam or even at a weekly quiz. You can see some kids who all week long they seem to have mastered the material, but on the test their brains are freezing up a little bit. And so you can just spot it from that pattern, while you'll see other kids who maybe didn't think were really paying attention in class, but they seem to get it all right on the test. And that's the warrior-worrier dichotomy in terms of helping them. You can help them by reminding them that these standardized tests are not judging them. They're judging the overall school, that they're part of the funding process and evaluation process for the entire school system, that they shouldn't personally feel threatened by this. Ashley, you want any other tips for the actual test?
Although they are sometimes individually being measured quite frequently, whether you get into a certain high school or, you know, certainly the SATs are affecting you individually for what college you might get into. So it's not just measuring the school.
Well, in particular with the SAT, but it also helps with the SAT. If you think you have a worrier child, it's very helpful to them to understand that college spots are not scarce, you know. UCLA runs a study. And every year they survey incoming freshmen, and they surveyed over 225,000 freshmen last year. And is it 73% of them got into their first choice college, were admitted to the first. 84% attended either their first or second choice college. And UCLA itself admitted 16,000 applicants, of whom over 9,000 turned UCLA down. So who's rejecting who here?
And you don't have to get into Harvard, Yale, or Princeton in order to have a bright future. But you critique standardized tests, and I was so interested in this because, as I said before the break, this is not your typical critique of standardized tests. You critique them for the way they interact with stress. So if we get stressed out in a richly challenging competition, that's one thing. But the issue you raise with standardized tests is that the final score is the only thing that matters. Can you explain that further for us, Ashley?
Right. Well, the competition is a zero-sum game. You succeeded, you got the marks you wanted, you got into the, you know, whatever you think the Harvard SAT score is, or you didn't. And that's it. If you succeeded, then it was worth your time. It was worth the SAT prep class. It was worth doing. If you did poorly, that's it, right? I mean, you don't say, well, I learned 4,000 new vocabulary words, so it was still a good use of my time. No, you didn't. You just, I passed or I didn't, and the rest of it's there. The competition, one of the things we were saying that's different in sort of spelling bees or swim teams or something like that, is there going in, you're not expecting to have to win. You're saying, I want to win, but I want to improve. I want to meet new friends. I want to learn new skills. So it's never, even though it's a competition set up in the same way that it's this zero sum, one or two people win and everybody else loses situation.
So another interesting thing is that you propose that less competition in school isn't the opposite of standardized tests. Positive competition can be a great learning tool. So what do you have in mind? Because the point is, it's not to avoid competition. It's to set up positive competitions.
Right. Well, I think we are talking about things like spelling bees, debate programs, science fairs. And enough. And I wouldn't say that there is this finite list of these are the ones that count. Mm-hmm. Because we do want kids to have things that they're actually interested in the subject. Although we also know from research that is coming out of the University of Missouri, kids like competition. There's something fun and exciting about being able to prove yourself, to win, even if it's your best friend. And in a pilot study that the University of Missouri has been doing, they're looking at kids who hated math and were sort of forced into math competitions, but end up, because of the intensity, because of the competition, loving math.
But they're not high stakes in the sense of a standardized test, and you wind up getting into the process of it,
right,
whether or not you win or lose the science fair. Anne in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, hi there, Brian. I was really curious about how much of this high-stake response to the stimuli of a test is really due to the parents, being kind of emotionally excessively engaged, you know, and that the child feels like, you know, their value to the parent is conditional on performance.
Poe, did you look into that at all?
Absolutely. And as Brian is, and that's certainly true, that anything that loads up the pressure on a kid, you know, kids who play tennis or ice skate, they might be familiar with this sense of, oh, no, my dad showed up and he's watching, and suddenly they can't perform quite as well as they normally do. Anything that loads up that pressure and stakes can be harmful to these kids. But that is also why, Brian, as you mentioned, we started this story with two siblings, both of whom come from the same home. Even when you have the same parents with the same expectations for both kids, you can still get very divergent performance under tests, partly because of this, in that particular case, this theorized comp gene interaction.
And to our caller, Dan, who's a teacher and wants to help his more worry-prone students take tests, Nathan in Nyack is calling in with a piece of advice. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. Thanks for doing the segment. It's very, very interesting stuff.
Thank you.
So I run a small tutoring company, and so I have a lot of experience with kids who are, you know, taking these big tests, the SAT and ACT. And a couple things I've noticed is that, I've been aware for a long time that I was, I guess, what you call a warrior, but that doesn't come easily to everybody. And I find that if you actually make kids aware of, you know, what's going on, as they're kind of experiencing a fight versus flight reaction to the stress, and that energy they're being given is hopefully is there to help them, that they can actually practice during extended mock exams, channeling that energy in a way that will actually give them more energy as opposed to, you know, have them completely freeze up. So that's one thing that I've actually found is helpful. And during these mock exams, if you can right before sort of tell them to just make sure they know they're breathing and kind of give them little meditation exercises, I found that that's improved some people's scores.
Good. Thank you.
Can I comment on that, which is that Jeremy Jameson did a study on Harvard students taking the GRE, prepping for the GRE, and he did exactly that. But he didn't overtly teach this. On a single cover page before they turned into the GRE, they read a little thing about how they're doing this study of how stress affects performance. And half the students read that new science shows that if you're anxious, that might actually help you. And so if you're feeling anxious, don't worry. It might be beneficial to your performance. And reading that single line boosted their math GRE scores by 50 points on a scale of 800. And a few months later, when they turned in their actual GRE scores, their GRE scores were 65 points higher than the controls. So exactly as Nathan is saying, feeling positive about this stress can really improve performance.
And there, real quick.
One thing to add to it is don't necessarily tell people calm down. Because sometimes you spend a lot of energy going, oh, I have to calm down, and you stop thinking about what you're actually doing. Instead, you're thinking, I'm too stressed.
And there we have to leave it with Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. Maybe you saw their widely emailed New York Times Magazine article about why some kids seem to perform better under pressure than others. Their book-length treatment of this is out now called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Great stuff. People obviously responding to this and learning from it. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian
Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, we'll begin a series on English language idioms, phrases you use. Where did they come from? Stay with us.